Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode here of Suspense Radio, first one in the new 2013. I am your host, John Robb, and today we are going to be kicking off 2013 in glorious style with three fabulous authors. First up, we're going to have author Judge James Bowell. Next, we're going to have Robert Pruby. I think I said that right. And then we're going to end it with military thriller Brad Taylor. So 2013 is off and running, and everything is going to be right here. 90 minutes, Suspense Radio starts right now. Same great music, too.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Thank everybody for joining us wherever you are, however you're listening, whenever you're listening, because we get most of our listens here on the archive section. So we want to thank you all. We want to thank for all your support in 2012. A lot of stuff that we're going to go over. We're going to do that at the end of the show because we want to jump right in here with our first guest of 2013. His name is Judge James Bell, and he wrote a book called Vampire Defense. And it's very interesting. It's one of the, this is one of the reasons we had to bring him on, because it's a very, very interesting premise of a book here. We want to thank Mr. Judge James Bell for coming on. So, sir, how are you doing today? And
it's
thank you so
awesome
much.
An awesome day. An awesome day, John. Thanks for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, thank you for coming on, because, like we said, we got an email from your publicist, Mary Glenn, who does a fabulous job. We work with her quite a lot. And she sent us over this great press release of this book called The Vampire Defense. And I'm like, oh, the vampire, I got to read this. And so then we start reading what's going on. And this is much different than the normal vampire that people are reading nowadays, which was so good to get off of that. You know, vampires are so nice and cuddly, and you want to, you know, have them in your house.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about The Vampire Defense. Of course, you're a former judge in Mississippi. You have a lot of insight. This is a legal thriller and more than that. So give us a behind-the-scenes look at your book, Vampire Defense.
Well, great. The premise is I have a young, really good lawyer who's a brilliant lawyer, and he keeps winning his cases. He's handling criminal cases. He keeps winning, got the best winning record in the area, but he's not getting any attention because none of his cases are media cases. And his friends know that one day he's going to really hit it big. They're just waiting for the big case. Well, a big case comes along. There's a spectacular fire in an old neighborhood in Jackson, Mississippi, and lots of witnesses see a shooting in the front yard, and they see this fella break into a house and flames and smoke, and he comes stumbling out of the house into the arms of a policeman and says, "I killed him," and then he later tells his lawyer that, you know, they can give me the death penalty. I don't care. My reason for living is over. I had to kill the monster that murdered my fiance. And what are you talking about? He said, Well, the fellow I killed was a vampire. And so the lawyer then defends him, saying that my client was so crazy that he believed, he honestly believed that the person he killed was a vampire. So the whole legal profession ridicules this silly defense, the vampire defense, and the world media comes to town also ridiculing the defense, and but also cults come to town attracted by all of this, and so the defense team gets threats, and then there's arson and kidnappings and murders, and so the action is fast through the book, lots of action and romance and comedy, and everything that happens in the story, even though it seems to be divergent, everything comes together at the end on a double climax that is really, really fun, and it's a real good versus evil story. And incidentally, it's also patterned after some of the cases I had in my career. Obviously, I didn't have a vampire defense case, but I had media frenzy cases. I had cases involving a cult and cases involving people who claimed to be attempting to murder somebody with voodoo and other, you know, just crazy cases. And so I borrowed from experience and created this story, and it was a lot of fun to write. And I'm told it's been a lot of fun to read. It's gotten all great reviews, 5-star reviews from readers and from professional reviewers.
Yeah, the one thing, you know, that when we sat there, we were reading the press release, we were talking with Mary about it, was I'd never heard of, you know, and I mean, you know, you always hear of, I guess, you know, crazy people going after and saying, yeah, I think that this person is an alien and they're stealing souls or, you know, things of that nature. But to actually use it kind of as a defense instead of saying my neighbor's dog, you know, like the son of Sam, you know, told me to do stuff.
Yes.
This was more of a legitimacy of I'm not really crazy. This is really what I think.
Yes.
And I guess that's the backstory, the subgenre within the whole story, you know, with your character John Brooks, who's the main character, and then the bad person, I guess you want to say, is your Hal Boyd. So you kind of thought of the case first and kind of created your characters within, or did you always know your life from being a lawyer and then to a judge that this is something kind of that you always wanted to do, and you kind of had your characters already kind of based out? And then this kind of idea came into your head, and you're like, now I got something that I can write about.
Well, let me tell you that process. I was having so much fun as a baby lawyer 35 years ago in law practice, and it was so interesting. Things that it never crossed my mind would happen. I'm defending somebody for doing, and I'm thinking, how in the world did they even think to do such a thing? And I met all kinds of interesting characters and people, and I guess I grew up naive and not realizing all the things people would do. And then, my first year of law practice, I started imagining, wouldn't it be great to get some spectacular case and get a lot of attention? And so I started sketching out. In fact, this story, I sketched out the beginning and the end, but I just never had time to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never really worked out the middle, but I knew the beginning and I knew the end. I would say 3 years ago, my wife around New Year's Eve was saying, you know, you've been talking about this book you'd like to write. Isn't it time that you do it? And so we made a New Year's resolution 3 years ago, and I bore down on it and began writing it, and it took me 2 years to write. And then the next time we made a New Year's resolution, we said, well, now we need to get the thing published.
Right.
And now
the hard part comes.
Yeah. I mean, I thought writing it was the hard part.
Right.
But getting it published and getting it marketed is a whole other journey. But it really helped to know the beginning and the end, because the middle was really turned out to be not that difficult when you know where you're going. And,
right.
And I could use experiences as a setup for events, because I would take some real event and blend it into the fiction. And that turned out to be not as difficult as you think when you're starting. That blank screen, when you sit down in front of your computer and you're going to write, that blank screen is intimidating at first, and then you just decide you will not accept that blank screen. You're going to go forward, and after a while, the story starts telling itself again, and that delete button is wonderful. You can get rid of the junk.
Exactly.
Yeah, and once we got to the point where I could see that I was within a few months of completion, so I started thinking about how am I going to sell this thing. And so a local college, I live in the Jackson, Mississippi area, and Millsaps College is there, and they offered a night course on how to sell what you write. And it was one night a week course, and the professor gave great ideas about things to do and how to go about selling your book. And he said, if you're going to write fiction, be finished with it before you try to sell it. It was his suggestion. And because there are too many people who have book ideas, so they won't listen to book ideas, he suggested, and get finished with it first. And then do a synopsis and something about you and a marketing plan and a sample chapter, and compress it all down to 10 pages or less so that you can send it off to prospective publishers or agents. And so the class really was about why to do it this way, how to do it this way, and then create your synopsis. So I did that. And when I was finished with the book, I just began mailing to. I bought several copies of Writer Markets,
right?
And I went to town sending off to those who looked like they might accept a project like this one. And I might have sent 50 synopses out, and got about 30 rejections. And every single rejection, I'd just be excited that at least I got a response. And
right,
each rejection means you're one step closer to getting it published. You got to go through
right.
rejections to get there. And among the people I gave the book to or sent a synopsis to was my teacher, James Dickerson with Sartorius Literary Group. He publishes Southern authors. And he called me and said, "I want your book." And
there you go.
So the fellow who taught the course got the book, and he's done an awesome job. I have seen the work he's put into it, and it's been an awesome amount of work. And he recommended, as you mentioned a moment ago, Mary Glenn McCombs, a publicist, to help people know about the book. It's not enough to just publish it. If nobody knows about it, nobody will ever buy it. And so Mary Glenn has really done a great job getting reviews for the book. And my goodness, it has. The Feathered Quill wrote a spectacular review for the book, and I'm so grateful to them for that. And Harriet Klausner, I understand Time Magazine called her the most influential reviewer in America. Wrote an awesome review. She called it terrific, over the top, and Feathered Quill called it excellent and applauded the book. And so that it's thrilling as a first-time author to get reviews like that.
Well, the funny thing, you know, when you're a lawyer, it's kind of almost a thankless job. You're kind of supposed to, you know, if you're a prosecutor, you're kind of supposed to win. And, of course, if you're a defense attorney, you know, you're kind of supposed to get the best deal or, you know, get your client off.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a thankless job. I mean, because you got half the people that hate you, half the people that like you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the thing is now is when you're getting out there and you're getting your book reviewed and you're getting it, you know, people are reading it. And, again, the website is vampiredefense.com find out a lot more about the book. You know, it's got to be a little bit more sense of accomplishment to know, you know, that you started this out, that you did this, and then you're getting a lot of great feedback back on it. So it's a lot more different than, of course, you know, your profession that you've been doing for so long.
That's right. And I want to recommend to those of you, there's so many of us who want to write and we have a book in us and we don't find the time or it seems too difficult or there, you know, if you just set a goal and do it it's a process of creation, and there is a lot of satisfaction in getting to the end, and when you can look back and say, you know, this really came together. This is a good story, and good grief, did I do that? So I recommend it to anybody, and if I can do it, anybody can do it. I tell you what.
And speaking of that, and we're speaking here with author Judge James Bell, and the book is Vampire Defense. Like I said, vampiredefense.com to check out more. But when you're an attorney, you're writing or reading pretty much all the time.
That's right.
I mean, writing is like an essential part. But it's
much different,
very technical writing yeah. briefs, writing, you know, a lot of motions and things like that. So then, you know, since you already have the basis to write, but then all of a sudden you're sitting down, you have to write a fictional thriller, fast-paced, something that's totally different that you've never done before. How was that kind of dynamic when you sat down for the very first time and said, all right, let's get to this, and then you're like, you say, the, and then it stops, and you're like, oh, shit, what am
yeah.
I going to do?
Well, I've always been a storyteller, and I'm a trial lawyer, and trial lawyers tell their clients stories. And because a jury wants to hear the story. They want to feel it. They want to experience it. And so when you are trying the case, you're trying to get the story out of witnesses, or in your opening or closing statement, you are delivering the story to the jury so that they can be moved by it and understand it. Because we humans like to think that we're logical, thinking beings. To some extent, sometimes we are, but we are basically emotional creatures. We move on emotion. We do the things we want to do, whether they're the right thing to do or not. And so people have to have a reason for making a decision, and that sometimes is logic, but frequently we use logic to justify the thing that it is that our emotion wants us to do. And I'm used to telling stories, and part of the story in this book, by the way, is I was hearkening back to the time when stories had a purpose, that there was a reason or a moral in the story, where you had characters who are faced with hard decisions, and then they have to draw on a foundation of character to make the right hard decision, even when it costs, or even when it's dangerous, or even when it would be so easy to do it another way. And some characters in the story make those hard decisions, and other characters in the story do not, and we see how that plays out. So I wanted to go back to the way entertainment used to be. there used to be a reason for it, other than mere entertainment of shock value. And so I think that's one reason a lot of people are enjoying this book. People are writing back to me how much they love the book. And so many people say they read it in 2 days. They just don't put it down.
Thriller readers and suspense readers, that's kind of what they do. When they get into something and they go, I mean, they go full bore. I mean, that's just what they do. You have the casual reader who will take a couple weeks maybe to read your book, you know, at night or whatever. But the hardcore fans, yeah, they'll pick it up, and if they like it, they'll just blow right through it in a day or 2 days.
Yeah, yeah. And now the book is available. The Kindle form is easy to get, you know, on Amazon.
Right.
Or you can go to, as you've said, vampiredefense.com, and from there you can order it through Amazon, and it's available. Any bookstore can order the paperback. You can order the paperback on Amazon or online, and the Kindle, of course, is easy to get. The book signings, I've been selling the signed copies of the book, and that's gone well.
Yeah, and that's one of the difficult things because, you know, you're new. Some people are like, oh, you know, well, who's this guy and what's this book? And, you know, and they're kind of a little bit timid. They kind of, you know, look back and they want to see some other things that are going on. But, you know, you're in Charlotte, North Carolina. You said now you've had some of these. So how's that experience been kind of on the road and seeing the people live and hearing them live instead of just, you know, the email and, you know, them you having to kind of, you know, sell yourself because they really don't know who you are. How's that journey kind of been for you?
Well, that's it's a little bit intimidating to sit at a table in Nashville. I'm from the Jackson, Mississippi area, and you end up in Nashville or Charlotte, North Carolina, where I am right now. We had a book signing last night that went very well. But it's kind of intimidating. You're sitting at this table, and people are coming in. They're really not coming to see me. They're coming to the bookstore. And they don't know about my book because it's not generally known. It's not on in the USA Today every day. So they come in, they see the sign, and I get to engage with them. And once they hear the premise of the story, they typically say, "Oh, well, that's different." And I don't know, half the time if they talk with me about the book, they leave with it, because they become intrigued in the story, and it's not just a vampire story, and it is a legal thriller, and
right.
The second half of the book, I guess, is primarily a lot of courtroom things and a lot of things that I have a lot of familiarity with. And I think that those things flow very well. And I think the first half of the book with a lot of action and fun and a setup for the story is fun. But I get to talk about that one-on-one with people, and that has been fun. People are so awesome. It's really they're kind as they come in. Nice. They want to engage, and you get to find out a little bit about them, and they tell me
right.
a little bit about themselves, The thing that I notice is how many of them, as I talk with them, tell me they've got a book they've been working on, and they'd like to write a book. And they ask me, how did you get this published, and what did you do, and how did you get finished with your story, and I want to finish mine, you know?
Right, exactly. And then, you know, but here's the one thing that people have to remember, and I say this 100, 1,000, 10,000 times. You wrote about what you knew. You wrote
yes.
about legal. You wrote about things that you knew. You didn't write a medical thriller. You know, you didn't go out and write something that you're not familiar with, which
yes.
makes it easier. That's the one thing that will intimidate a new author more than anything. Let's say they love to read historical thrillers, but they couldn't even point Indiana out on a map. That's not the genre for you.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing that they need to take away that you did.
Oh, yeah.
That you know, they wrote about what you know.
Yeah.
And now that you've done it, are we going to see a series? Are we going to see sequels? What are we going to see from you now coming into the future, now that you've already made it over that first hump of that first book, and now that you're going to be like, all right, now this is fun. Now I kind of have an idea about what to do. What are you going to do?
Well, my wife and I were talking about that last night. I have started another book, and I've got two others sketched out, but she convinced me to do two different books, and one would be, and they would be based on cases that I have. They're going to be fictionalized versions of cases
mm-hmm.
that I've handled. I've handled a high school shooting case, and there's a great deal
oh.
of interest in that, of course. And
yep.
And that case involved a satanic cult, in which the leader of the cult was talking the shooter into shooting, into doing
wow.
the shooting, and so I ran into a lot of that stuff in that case, and then in another I had a fellow who was suffered from multiple personality disorder, and. Broke into
so did you have to defend all of his personalities or just one?
Well, no. Let me tell you how that went. He broke into a house with two other fellas, And the two other guys stole the things burglars would steal, and he stole a pillowcase full of panties. Then they stole a pickup truck from the house, drove across the Mississippi River, and when he got across the river, he bought the tires off the pickup truck from the guys he just stole. He was with stealing it, and then he was arrested. And so I explained that Buck broke into the house because Buck is a burglar. Debbie stole a pillowcase full of panties, and then Leonard bought the tires off the truck.
Oh my God!
And
so you just can't make that stuff up.
Yeah,
you just can't.
And,
I mean, you just can't make that up.
Yeah, and so I was explaining to the prosecutor and to the jury that they were prosecuting the wrong guy. You know, Leonard
right.
is a little wimp. They need to be prosecuting Buck. he was not guilty by reason of insanity.
And that's the fun thing, you know, when you do legal thrillers is you just, I mean, some of the things that come out are really just so much stranger than fiction. And, you know, I want to just tell you that, you know, I want to thank you so much for coming on today and to talk about your book, Vampire Defense. You know, it's a great way here for, you know, people looking for, you know, everybody's always looking for new stuff. This is something that is new. I mean, not only just a new book for yourself, but it's a new premise. It's kind of, you know, it's all kind of a new idea
thank
in the
you.
Thriller reign. And so, I mean, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And
well, thank
excited
you, John.
To see what you got coming on in the future.
Thank you, John. And remember, vampiredefense.com, you can buy it on the order now button.
All right, yeah. So, Mr. Judge James Bell, enjoy yourself. Enjoy Mississippi. Have a great time. And, again, stay in touch, and let's see what you got coming up in the future.
Thanks a lot, John.
All right, have a good one.
You too. Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is Judge James Bell. The book is Vampire Defense. VampireDefense.com is the website to check out this new legal thriller that I know you'll be intrigued with. The pace is extremely quick, and that's just what we like our thrillers to be. Everything's kind of in there, a whole bunch of intrigue and a whole bunch of action. We are going to be back here with our next guest coming up. His name is Robert Poby, and I believe I said that right. Hopefully I said that right. And he's going to be on here in about, a couple minutes. And in the meantime, you're going to be able to listen to this.
I can feel no sense of measure, no illusion as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we make real. We'll be right back.
everybody, and thank you so much for staying with us here on this first episode of 2013. Our next guest here is the author of Mannheim Rex. His name is Robert Pobey, and we want to thank Robert for coming on to the show. So, Robert, thank you so much. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, John?
Good. So, two books of ours that we reviewed, Mannheim Rex is the latest one, and then the last one was Blood Man. And pretty much, you know, you are kind of a night, you know, you are an up-and-coming author that people need to start putting on the radar because of, you know, the books that you write and the ideas and the things that you bring out into your writing. So give us a little bit here about Mannheim Rex and some of the behind-the-scenes, you know, stuff about your about the book, about your character, Gavin Corley, and everything that's kind of, you know, wrapped up into this nice little shell here.
Okay. Little's not a word that most people use to describe the book. It's about 500 pages, so a lot of people say, wow, it's a monstrous tome. Well, Gavin's a horror writer. Mannheim Rex is about Gavin, who his wife has died, and he's having a really tough time. He's in New York City, and all he's doing is drinking and thinking about killing himself. So he realizes he's got to get out to the country. He's got to get away from things, so he buys a small house out on the lake. And he thinks he's gone from one, you know, the concrete ecosystem to the forest. And while he's there, people start disappearing, and he realizes that this little idyllic lake that he lives on probably has a lot more sinister past than he thought. And there's a monster on the lake. And it could be human, could not be human. Is there more than one monster? These are things that he starts to question when he gets out there. And he meets a little boy who's a 13-year-old boy with cancer who fishes all the time. And they become friends, and there's this sort of this story about he finds a new life for himself. This boy finds a father figure because his father died a few years ago. And in the process, they begin to hunt down this monster. And that, in a nutshell, is Mannheim Rex.
Yeah, so you kind of have, you know, the dynamic because, you know, you're bringing in, you know, a young character with an older character. So you kind of got the dynamic going on between this and that and a lot of cat and mouse and a lot of, you know, chase and things like that, action adventure. So, you know, what was kind of the premise behind, you know, did you have the idea first of Mannheim Rex? Did you kind of already have the character set in motion? You know, what's kind of like your writing style when you decide that you're going to do a new book?
All my books have turned out to be the same thing. I sit down, and it's almost as if the book's fully formed in my head. And I tell it, like a lot of friends ask about this, and I don't always make sense when I talk about writing because writing is such an internal and natural thing for me that when I try to explain it in an external way, it always ends up sounding a little bit demented. But when I sit down to write it, it's not so much writing as it is remembering. I mean, Gavin was fully fledged when I sat down. Mannheim Rex, I mean, that was the title from, I think, before I put the first word down on paper, which is really unusual, I think, talking to a lot of people. The same thing happened with Blood Man. The books that I tend to grab onto and carry all the way through to the end are the ones that just, you know, sprout up in my skull fully formed. I guess that's just the best way to put it.
Yeah, so you kind of already have, like, the beginning, middle, and end, and it's kind of already, you know, there, and now you just have to put it on paper so people can read it because they can't read your mind.
Yeah, basically, that's what it is. I mean, we all have, you know, stories we're drawn to or type of things we're drawn to. Mannheim Rex, I mean, there's a lot of the mythology from Jaws and Moby Dick and the aquatic monster creature, you know, that had to come into that. So, I mean, you know, there's characters and places named after things in Jaws, after, you know, things in Moby Dick, bizarre, you know, B-movies like Great White from the 1970s. I put little tidbits here and there. But, you know, at least the way I work, like with Blood Man, there was no way I couldn't, you know, look at Hannibal Lecter and everything Thomas Harris has done for the genre. You can't write a serial killer book without the specter of Harris over your shoulder. And the same thing, you can't write a book about a, you know, a creature eating people in the water without Peter Benchley or Herman Melville over your shoulder. So I think any book I tend to tackle has to have something, I'm not going to say big about it, but it has to have some sort of a history to it.
So was that kind of the books when you decided, hey, you know, this is something that I want to do when you were reading, those are kind of the books that you kind of gravitated to as a person?
Yes and no. I mean, Mannheim Rex really was the creature, in a way. I mean, a lot of people call it a creature book. A lot of people call it a love story. A lot of people call it a horror story. I'm not sure really where it fits in, but It's the book that I always wanted to read. And I sat down to write a monster story, and it sprouted off in a lot of directions. I mean, you know, Gavin's relationship with Finn and with the new love in his life, and Sheriff Pope. There's a sheriff in the book who has a cockroach circus that lives in his head, and Sheriff Pope really enjoys when the cockroaches come out and perform for him. but they'll only perform when he loads them up on vodka and Benzedrine, and he does terrible things to other people. So there's a lot of different elements that happen in Mannheim Rack. So it's not just the, you know, the modern telling of Moby Dick, although that's a big part of it.
And, you know, and a lot of these books, like Mannheim Rack, and again, and Robert Pobie's website is robertpobie.com, P-O-B-I, to find out more information about Mannheim Rack and his other works. When you have a book, like you said, it's 500 pages. Okay, well, I mean, a lot of people can find that intimidating. But if it's a good book, if, you know, something that you're intrigued with, and kind of like The Hobbit, people are like, oh, it's 3 hours long. Yeah, but I saw it; it didn't feel like 3 hours. I thought it was excellently done, and I liked it. So, but when you're in and you're submersing yourself, you have to have like a lot of secondary characters, a lot of other things that kind of have to come together. And I know that you say that you kind of have the book in your head, but when you have a secondary character that kind of pops up and then you start writing and then all of a sudden they're a little bigger and a little bigger and a little bigger and you're like, where the hell did they come from? Do you kind of have that in, like, Mannheim Rex? Is there kind of that character that kind of came up?
Absolutely. I think as much as I can say I sit down and the whole thing's done in my head, I mean, the amount of surprises, I mean, that's what makes the book interesting for me to write as well. David Morrell, I saw David who wrote First Blood, is, I guess, one of his big hits. And Brotherhood of the Road. David was talking. He says, if you want to spend, you know, 8 months or 6 months or 12 months or, you know, a year and a half of your life with a book, the book has to be interesting. It has to be a subject you want, and it's got to surprise you along the way. And every time I sit down to write, I learn something, and something pops into my head, or I meet a character. I mean, Sheriff Pope is a prime example. I just thought he was going to be a regular small town sheriff, but as soon as he's walking up to the house, and, you know, the first time we meet him a few chapters in, you know, his head's buzzing from the Benzedrine. He's trying to wipe the Budweiser off of his mouth. So I didn't see that coming. So, no, there's definitely the element of surprise. And I think that's any writer that doesn't get that's not doing it properly. They're missing something. It's one of the greatest gifts writing gives is the surprises to the author, you know?
Yeah, and that's the one thing. You know, when you can surprise yourself while you're writing, I think that you've probably done, you know, an outstanding job. And when you can kind of look back at it, you're like, wow, I kind of nailed it. And you always kind of have that one sentence or that one kind of paragraph that's in the book that kind of captures, like, the essence of what you were trying to get out. You know, where in Mannheim Rex is kind of like that sentence or that paragraph that you think just, like, captures the essence of exactly, you know, the book and Gavin and the sheriff and everybody that you're just trying to put together, Finn, that's in there?
That's a pretty good question, actually. I've never heard this one before, and I've heard a lot of questions now. There's a chapter, there's a final paragraph, I forget which chapter it is, where I describe the lake where they're living is closing down for the winter. And I describe how it's going to go to, you know, cryogenic suspended animation for the wintertime. And it's just the way the whole, I guess that's the one paragraph that does it for me. And the final sentence in that, but there are preparations to be made, feeding to be done. And so it kind of shows about the violence of the ecosystem. It's not as calm as things are. So it's like everything looks great and beautiful on the surface, but underneath there's still, you know, madness happening. I think that's what sums this book up for me.
Yeah, and you know, the reason why I kind of ask that is, like I just said, it's just you always have that sense of, you know, when you're finished, I guess you want to have, like, great lines, you know, like, you know, Dirty Harry, you know, make my day. That's kind of
absolutely.
You know, remember. And that's like the essence of the movie. They just know. It's like, come on, you know, make my day. And you're like, oh, man, that guy's an ass. Or, you know, that guy's tough, you know, tough as nails.
Yeah, well, but the trick with that is, too, is you don't want to end up sounding like David Caruso from, you know, CSI Miami. That's also
yeah.
a worry
yeah.
with those great lines. So, you know, you're absolutely right. And that's, I mean, whenever you set out to write anything, I don't care if it's a short story or a grocery list, it's got to have some sort of impact. It's got to do what it's supposed to do. And a novel, if you're lucky, you get a few sentences like that, you get a few characters like that, you get a few paragraphs like that. When I was finishing Blood Man, a friend of mine was over and we're having drinks and talking about the book. And the first line in the book is a handful of ghosts skittered across the bottom of the ocean in jerky seesaw roll. And the word handful I agonized over. I didn't know if I should use family or a group or a few or five. And my friend looks at me and she says, you do this for everything in the book? I said, pretty much every single word goes through this whole filter system in my head. Some of it comes out easy and you get it right the first time. Sometimes you have to do it 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 times if it comes out right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as an author, what kind of, you know, you mentioned David Morrell, and, you know, he does a lot of teaching and a lot of things, like if you go to Thriller Fest and people go to Craft Fest, in July in New York City. They'll see a lot of the authors that are giving, you know, they're basically teaching you for, you know, and you get all of their tricks and stuff from their head. What's kind of like the one kind of advice that you've been able to take away from, you know, talking with other authors or seeing other things that you've been able to stay with and incorporate, you know, into your writing?
Well, it's a couple of things. The first thing is that nothing I do is wrong. I think every writer, when we start out, am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? If I've done it this way, is that the way it's supposed to be done? And I mean, the old famous, you know, William Somerset Maugham said there's three steadfast rules to writing. Unfortunately, nobody knows what they are. And I think meeting other people, like meeting David Morrell or Jeff Deaver, who I've talked to a couple of times, or all these guys, the great thing about meeting other writers, especially real, you know, big powerhouses that are doing well in the industry and, you know, keep producing good work, is that there is nothing you do that's unacceptable. You know, if it works for you, that's what you go with. And that's, as a new writer, it took me a while to not just to understand that, but to grasp that and really believe in it. If it's working for me, if one-word sentences work for an entire paragraph, that's what I use. You know, and yet if I talked to my, you know, 11th grade grammar teacher, she would have said, you're out of your mind. You can't do this. So that's one of the great lessons. I'm trying to think of something else. Be yourself. I mean, trust your voice. Write like you think. Write like you talk. Try not to use $10 words when a 50-cent word will do. Don't over-describe things. You know, if you want to say the guy sat down at the table, you write the guy sat down at the table.
Right. I mean, the one thing that's always intrigued me is when people like, okay, another one, I'm just going to take Lee Child, you know, for example, like Jack Reacher. He's never really explained how Reacher looks in any of
No.
his books. He's
No.
never done it. And so the funny thing was when people came out and they said that Tom Cruise was going to play him, they're like, oh, they're all upset. And it's like, yeah, but you don't even know what the hell he looks like, so how can you really be that upset? So he's more of a simplify. And I think that, you know, when we reviewed your books, you know, Mannheim Rex and Blood Man, it was that simplify. It was that to know that you're not overthinking it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Blood Man is definitely an example of that. I think you can go through Blood Man. There's very few wasted words in Blood Man. Mannheim Rex is a little bit bigger. It's a little flowery. I mean, the old question of how purple is purple prose supposed to be, you know? So Mannheim Rex has a little bit more going on. But Mannheim Rex clocked in at around 147,000 words. Blood Man was 105. The new novel is going to be 93,000 words, River of the Dead. And I don't know if it's not because I'm running out of time. I think it's because I'm becoming a better writer as I go along. And I learned to say things in one sentence or three sentences or one paragraph that would have taken me two or three or four pages, you know, before. And I think that's part of the learning process as a writer, too. Hopefully. I mean, you know, some people go on to write huge, expansive tomes that make the Bible look like it's short. But,
right. You
know, hopefully I get tighter and tighter as a writer. That's my goal.
Well, and you know, with so many authors today bringing out a lot of series, and again, we're speaking here with author Robert Pobie, and his latest book is called Mannheim Rex. Go to robertpobie.com, P-O-B-I, to find out more information about that, Blood Man, and the newest book coming out, River of the Dead, later. So I just really forgot what the hell I was just going to ask you.
You were talking about series, I think.
Oh, yeah. So a lot of people, you know, are coming out and they want to do these series. Is that something that you're going to consider, or do you like to do the standalones? Because, you know, there's always two different schools of thought. It is when people do series, they really stop kind of becoming, I guess, artistic and very creative because they're just kind of writing the same, you know, kind of story just in a different context. But, they're, you know, people love their character. Whereas standalone, you always start off with a blank screen every single time. You have to create the whole thing from scratch again. What do you see yourself maybe doing in the future?
That's another good question. I've always said I don't want to do a series, and just for those reasons. I mean, I think a prime example, again, we'll go back to Thomas Harris's, you know, Hannibal Lecter, Silence of the Lambs, and Red Dragon. I mean, to me, that's one of the top five American novels
yeah.
ever written, period. I mean, we're talking with Huckleberry Finn, and I mean, it is a great, great book. But as you get further into the series, you can see that I think he became a little bit bored. With the character. So that's what's, you're absolutely right. I am terrified of sitting down to do a book two or a book three with this, God forbid a book four. I can't see keeping it fresh for myself. And if I can't see keeping it fresh for myself, I definitely can't see keeping it fresh for readers, you know?
But the one, you know, and maybe the one thing you can do is, you know, you decide, hey, I got this epic story, like let's say, you know, it's let's say something like a Mannheim Rex, but it's much bigger than that. It's going to be much more epic. And you're going to do a trilogy with it, or you know, you're just going to do two books with it and things like that. You know, maybe that's something that, you know, writers can do in the future. Or, you know, I don't know if you have that idea going on or not. So
well,
to kind of give, you know, a little bit more.
The book that I finished, I'm three books ahead already from what's come out. So the book that's coming out after River of the Dead is called Deselected. And when I talked to my editor at Simon & Schuster Canada, it hadn't been sold in the States then yet, I was talking to Allison, and we were discussing the book, and I said, well, you know, it's the first part in a trilogy. I'm just not writing book two and book three. And there was this, like, odd, awkward silence on the phone, and she says, I've never heard a writer say that before. And it's just because I can't see, because each book you put, I mean, between editing and going back to it, you're looking at a year out of your life. And I don't know if I want to spend 2 years out of my life with characters. I'm not going to say it's never going to happen. It's just not something I see for myself right now, because I'm just getting going in my career. I'm 45. There's a lot of books I want to write. I don't think I'm at the point yet where I can start thinking about revisiting things. There's too much to explore, you know?
Right. I mean, and that's one of the things. So you have, you know, do you think that this is kind of the genre that you're going to be in? Like you said, it's very difficult to maybe pinpoint exactly, you know, if it's a little horror or thriller or dark suspense and things like that. Is this kind of where you feel comfortable? If you have something, you know, outside the lines in the box that you're really going to try to explore, you know, as an author coming up later?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the rubric thriller is pretty loose for a lot of what I do. I mean, Blood Man, it's about a serial killer, but it's a deep psychological thriller that. The next
right.
book, River of the Dead, is a detective novel. The novel after that, Deselected, is a techno thriller, very very much in the vein of Michael Crichton. So I don't think I'm ever going to really leave suspense or something that, you know, the chapter's going to leave you wanting to turn the pages. I think that's where my goal is. I mean, I've got some ideas for some other books, but I'm still at the point where I like the Rock'em Sock'em Robots type of reading. You know, I love it when a reader has to turn the page, and I get emails from readers saying, oh, we couldn't put this book down. I stayed up for 2 days reading it. You know, thanks a lot. That's what I really like about this. And if I can keep doing that right now, that's my goal. Another few years, I will see that things are bound to change.
And now, do you do a lot of events? Do you do a lot of, you know, do you go out and do book signings? Do you do mainly everything, you know, like this, like radio or blogs and internet and stuff like that for, you know, your appearances?
I do. In a way, I think I do way too much. In another way, I think I don't do enough. I mean, I've got a blog I should be upkeeping, and I do, but I...
Oh, my God, isn't that difficult? I'll tell you. It's difficult for me to keep up our blog. You know what? I always feel like, do people really want to hear this? Do they really want to hear what's in my head? I mean, I can write it down, but do they really care? You just don't know, and that's why
I started the blog, and my agent said, you should get a blog going. So I put one up. This is well before we had sold the first book. And I've got, you know, 20,000 people that check the blog now on a relatively regular basis, and I have no idea how this happened. But, again, I don't understand. The interviews, book signings, and all those things don't really make sense to me in the fact that the book is what it should be interesting about me, not how I wrote the book or what my favorite color is or, you know, what my opinion on global warming is, which are the kind of questions that people sometimes ask me. And I can't figure it out. I'm just thinking, you know, you should like the book, and that's all there is to it. But it doesn't seem to work that way. So I try to be as comfortable and as you know, efficient as I can. But like I said before, it's such an internal process for me that explaining it out loud, I always feel like I'm up sounding like an idiot.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the biggest questions that every published author gets, you know, from, you know, somebody is, oh, my God, I want to write. How'd you get your book published? Okay, yeah, because I have the blueprint to do that. You know, I just wrote something that was good and it got it sold. There's no, you know, it's kind of like, I always think it's funny. It's like, you know, at the end of the national title game last Monday was, you know, they asked Nick Saban, you know, so how's it feel to win the national title? Well, what's he going to say? Oh, it feels like crap. I mean,
yeah,
it's the stupidest question ever. Yeah.
But
it's like
how do you get to second base? It's the same thing. Once you're there, you know how to do it. But it's the first time that you're not really sure about. I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's kind of always, you know, I don't know if you feel that pressure every time when you have a new book, like it's your first one, and it's, you know, even though you've done it before, do you kind of feel that pressure to be like, God, you know, Mannheim Rex was, you know, really greatly reviewed and people loved it. Oh, my God, I got to amp it up now because I don't want to disappoint.
If I start doing that, I know my work is going to suffer. I look at it this way. I wrote these books without an audience sitting over my shoulder. I've got to keep writing that way. Otherwise, if I start trying to, you know, gauge the market or judge what people are going to like, I mean, the reason I think these books have done so well, and Blood Man, I mean, I sold Blood Man in 12 countries now. It made Oprah's reading list last year. I went to number 10 on the bestseller list in France. I'm picking up a lot of steam. And I wrote that book, you know, locked away in my office above my kitchen in this slope-ceiling, you know, room that I have. I wasn't sure anybody was ever going to see that book. So I've got to keep writing the same way. Now, that being said, it sounds all cool and smarmy and yeah. Can I do that is the next question. I'm absolutely aware that there's an audience out there now. And the biggest struggle I find, now that I'm a published writer that's got some momentum behind him, is not, you know, becoming paralyzed by the specter of the audience looming over my shoulder. Because I know that as soon as I start writing, you know, people are sharpening up their pencils for the criticisms. And how do I avoid worrying about that, you know?
And now here's one of the most, and I've been kind of saving this to the end, it's one of the most important questions I can ask. Are you still jamming to Ace of Spades by Motorhead?
All the time. Are you kidding? I could not live without Lemmy.
That's the thing. So, you know, so you are still a big rocker guy because, you know, on your blog, people are going to see that, you know, you got Motorhead Live 81 sitting on there. And if people don't know who that is, I mean, you know, you got to have the
If you don't know who Motorhead is, don't even bother listening to the radio.
Right. Don't even pick up metal music because my passion has always been 70s and 80s metal, a little bit into the 90s, but then kind of after that I've kind of lost a lot of interest. A couple new bands are a little decent, like Avenged Sevenfold and things like that, but that's kind of the stuff that I grew up on. And I think that gives a lot of great inspiration for horror and thriller and stuff like that because people still view it as dark, and it just kind of has that thing about it that you really can't explain why you love it so much.
It's got that energy that vibrates from your tailbone right up to your brain. My whole body shakes when I listen to that music, and I listen to a lot of it when I write, too. And I think that helps me get the pace going a lot of the time.
Yeah, when I write, I cannot have it quiet. I got to have some kind of music going on because it kind of gets me going. I can't sit here and in complete silence. It'll drive me crazy if I have complete silence.
The problem is, I've started playing records a long time ago when I write. I listen to vinyl, and I do it because it actually forces me to get out of my chair. Because other times, I mean, you know, I'll be working, and next thing I know, I blink, and it's a different season, or I've got a beard or something. And I'm not kidding. I will sit in my chair for 14 hours. I'll become dehydrated. I will forget to drink because I'm working, and I get into the zone so much. So, music helps that way, too. It's a forced break.
Yeah, and that's just one of the great things is, you know, you can kind of get the love of books and music, and it's like, and it's all the art, and it's all the stuff that kind of, you know, wraps together, and it just, I don't know, I mean, there's just some kind of love fest with it that either you kind of love it or you hate it, and, you know, that's just the kind of stuff that I love, too.
Oh, yeah, well, I was watching Californication a while ago, and there's a great scene, Rob Lowe plays a character named Eddie Nero, and he's talking about writers, and he says that writers are always these pasty, white-haired, little flabby guys. He was a little bit harsher language than that. And, you know, they just sit in their dark little rooms like mushrooms doing nothing. And I've met guys like that, but I've also met a lot of great other writers that are the other way that are, you know, out listening to music, playing music, painting, you know, doing stuff all the time. I tend to subscribe more to that school of thought. I'm always, if I'm not writing, I'm going 110% at something else.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Robert, I mean, we kind of know you got when is River of the Dead going to come out? And, you know, do you have any idea of when River of the Dead is going to be out? Or
River of the Dead is coming
out.
I don't have an American pub date yet. I know it's coming out in the UK June the 6th.
Does that mean that you can't even get it on Amazon Kindle if it's in the Canadian?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I know that there's some, you know, cross-border embargoes. But I know you can order the paperback from the UK. That's not a problem. Canada's not going to be publishing it till the end of next year as well, so we haven't got that all tied up. That book I actually wrote for a contractual obligation in the UK. They wanted another quote-unquote police novel, and I didn't consider Blood Man to be a police novel, so I'd written that kind of by accident, and it's now taken off. My agent sold it in 5 different countries, so in the next couple of weeks I should know more what's happening with that book.
Okay, yeah, that's good. Yeah, I mean, you know, we'd love to be able to, you know, stay in touch on exactly everything that's coming on because, you know, we reviewed your first two, Mannheim, Blood Man and Mannheim Rex, the latest one. You know, we love them all, so you got to stay,
I'll stay in touch. You guys call Blood Man a masterpiece. As far as I'm concerned, that makes you number one in my books. I'm not going to complain.
Well, hey, Robert, we want to thank you so much for coming on. And, you know, you just have a great day, and we will, you know, talk with you later.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time and the opportunity. Take
care.
All
right, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Robert Pobey, his book, Mannheim Rex, robertpobey.com, P-O-B-I, to check out that. Blood Man, got a lot of other stuff coming on. He's keeping up his blog. And, hell, if you want to watch the Motorhead, he's got that on there, too. So we're going to be back here with our last guest of the night, Brad Taylor, talking about his stuff. And we will see you here in just a little bit. Enjoy. Yeah, it's going to be chilly here, which kind of sucks. So. welcome back, everybody, here for our last segment of our first show of 2013. Again, if I don't be able to do this, I want to be able to thank Judge James Bell, who was on first, and then we just had Robert Pobey on to discuss their books. We just had this author in our magazine to discuss his book, and it's great to be able to talk about him. He's moving up the ranks very quickly in the, I guess you want to say, political military thriller genre. You can call it whichever one you want. They're both really the same. And his name is Brad Taylor. His first book came out. It was One Rough Man, which we read back last year, which was fabulous. And so now we have him on here for Enemy of Mine. It's the second in his Pike Logan thriller series. So, Brad, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you much for having me.
Yeah, so here we go. So now that you wrote two books with the same character, now you're in the series. And Pike Logan is now back in Enemy of Mine. So can you kind of give us a little bit about, you know, for people who don't know, a little backstory of Pike and a little bit about Enemy of Mine and kind of, you know, behind-the-scenes book?
Sure. Actually, this is the third book in the series. All Necessary Force was number two, which came out last year.
Oh.
And I took a step back with Enemy of Mine. The first two were kind of a global threat, or at least a threat to national sovereignty of the United States. And I'd always wanted to write about Hamas and Hezbollah. I wanted to write about some terrorist groups that had finite political goals, because Americans, we tend to lump them all together in one big lump. And so I started sketching the plot out. I stepped back a little bit. It's just going to be an assassination of a single guy, more of a, I guess, more Day of the Jackal than like Some of All Fears or something like that. But as I started plotting the thing, in One Rough Man, the very first book, Mr. Bad Guy actually escapes. And I wrote that as just because I thought it was poetic justice for this other guy that's in the book, Harold Standish, in the book. And Lucas Cain gets away. He's a murdering sociopath. And I started getting emails about, you know, wait, they leave a hook. Why don't you finish the book? You know, they thought it was leading into All Necessary Force. Well, he doesn't even show up in All Necessary Force. As far as I was concerned, that book was complete. But I got so much email about it, I was like, I guess I do need to bring him back. So I brought him back in Enemy of Mine, and he ended up kind of consuming the book like Darth Vader. He became a central focus of the book, and I had to meld him into the plotline itself.
So we're kind of going, you know, Enemy of Mine, you know, kind of amps up the action from, you know, a little bit One Rough Man. And was that something that you intentionally kind of did, knowing that, hey, you know, now it's time to start, you know, getting things, you know, going maybe a little bit more faster paced? Because, I mean, that, you know, that's just kind of what you do, is you just kind of, you know, with military thrillers, I mean, they kind of have to go very quick because you got a lot of stuff going on and a lot of things happening.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge for you.
It is a definite challenge. I'd say, though, that the pacing, both in All Necessary Force and Enemy of Mine, is more of a function of me just becoming a better writer. ORM, One Rough Man, was literally like 185,000 words when I was done with it, because you got your entire life to write your first book.
Right.
And I had to, you know, when it finally sold, it was with a huge caveat of, you need to chop this thing down. So I had a lot to learn about pacing and characterization and things like that, and I think I just gotten better as a writer. I don't tend to amp up, which is actually the reason I took a step back. I don't want Pike Logan to end up, you know, how many times is this guy going to save the world type thing. Because what I want as a reader to really enjoy the book, and it doesn't necessarily have to be some global thing. I went with, there's going to be an assassination of an American envoy, and how are Pike going to stop that thing?
And, you know, for people who might not know, you know, you were, you know, you were commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army Infantry. You served 21 years. You retired as Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel. So you kind of went through a lot in your military career, so you saw a lot. So when you're able to kind of write about, you know, the things that are in your book and Pike Logan, you're speaking a lot from experience. And, you know, how much of that was great to be able to pull from? And, you know, that's the kind of, you know, you lived it for 21 years and probably a little bit longer, and you're able to throw yourself like that into your books.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, to be honest with you. On the one hand, yeah, I it's real easy for me to write the action scenes. It's real easy for me to visualize what's going to happen. I don't write about anything that I've actually done. It is fiction, but you can't help but write about, I mean, you're going to use your experiences when you write, so that helps out a great deal. On the flip side, there's a lot of things that I know that are classified that I cannot write about because they're classified.
Right.
So I ended up painting myself in the corner. You know, okay, they're going to find Abu Bag of Donuts, Terrorist X, at this location. How would I do it? And in my head, I know how I do it, but I can't put that on the page because it's classified. So I have to figure out some way of doing it that is, one, realistic, but just not necessarily accurate.
Yeah, and, you know, do you have, like, CIA, FBI, things like that? Do they, you know, go back and do they read your books? Do they want to see things that you had written and things that you had in there? We had talked with Brad Thor and Vince Flynn before, and they had said that some of the stuff, you know, that they asked to get information, that they had to have it read over first to see if it was actually able to be printed. Because that's the behind-the-scenes part that a lot of readers don't understand, that you can't write some of that stuff. You know, you have to kind of make it up a little bit because it is classified.
Well, there's honestly, for fiction, there's not any kind of American governmental standard for writing fiction. There is no requirement for it to be reviewed. With my background, because of what I know, they have been reviewed. Not because, I mean, I didn't have to submit them for review, because at the end of the day, you can always say it's a, you know, First Amendment thing. But I definitely did not want anything to harm national security. I've had every book I write, I have people on active duty read it and say, is there anything in here you would rather I take out? And they come back and say, yeah, don't say this, don't say that, and I take it out. But as far as an official government, I mean, I researched this quite a bit before I even started writing. As an official government function, if you write nonfiction, like No Easy Day, something like that, that about a true story, that's definitely got to be reviewed if you were a government official in it. Now, Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down, he didn't have to get anything reviewed for his book. He's a civilian. But if you're a government official, either in the CIA or in Special Forces, and you write a nonfiction book, it has to be reviewed.
Interesting. See, and those are always the things that always fascinate me. It's just, you know, I love to be able to know, you know, those types of things. And now for people who are just kind of getting to know who you are, because now, like you said, and I made a mistake, it's the third Pike Logan thriller. So now that you got three books out, and now people are starting to recognize and they see you on the shelves more, and they're like, who is this Brad Taylor guy? How do you kind of let them know, hey, yeah, you know, Enemy of Mine is the third Pike Logan book. You know, you can start with this one, or you can go back, or, hey, you know what, why don't you go back and grab One Rough Man and kind of get yourself going and familiar with it. How do you kind of handle that when they ask you those things?
Well, I tell them that, you know, right up front, all of them are standalone books. The only thing you'll get, I would say punishment, not really punishment, but there are spoilers in All Necessary Force that allude to One Rough Man. There are spoilers in Enemy of Mine that allude to All Necessary Force. They have nothing to do with the plot. Just comments people make, I call them Easter eggs. So if you've read All Necessary Force, you'll read that in Enemy of Mine and go, aha, I know what he's talking about. But if you go backwards, you're going to get a spoiler. You'll know something that's going to happen in Enemy of Mine or in All Necessary Force. But I definitely, people ask, how should I start this out? And I mean, it's only three books, so I naturally say, well, start with number one, you know, One Rough Man.
Right, yeah, I mean, because it is three, and, you know, it's not like it's 23 where, you know, you have some authors out there that have that many books out
right.
there.
And actually, I'm kind of torn with it because I think I have gotten to be a better writer. And so I kind of want to go, well, One Rough Man is not nearly as good as Enemy of Mine. Do I really want to send them to that one? They may never get to Enemy of Mine, so...
And so, you know, you kind of struggle with that stuff in your head because, you know, as you're writing and, you know, your third book, and everyone says that the third book, you know, that's the one that's going to pop you. That's the one that, you know, that starts taking you off into a totally different, you know, direction where you can go back and you can see all the stats from, you know, people say the third book is the one. And your character, you know, Pike starting off in the first one and now coming up here, there's always an emotional roller coaster and there's always changes that, you know, he kind of makes. Has he kind of went the kind of way that you thought he was going to do, or has he done something totally different starting from the beginning and now up through Enemy of Mine?
He hasn't done anything totally different, but to be honest with you, I wish I could say that I had some kind of holistic plan for book 52 and that's where he's going to end up. I just kind of just start writing. And Enemy of Mine did end up, it wasn't planned this way, but it ended up being sort of a trilogy. It closes a loop from One Rough Man through All Necessary Force. It wasn't any conscious plan, but bringing Lucas Kane back, tying a lot of loose ends up, it did end up being a trilogy.
Yeah, and so do you have any idea of, you know, kind of with Pike going on and this and that, I mean, do you have, like, some secondary characters that you're starting to see come out here in these three books that are like, wow, you know, maybe I want to explore a little bit more with them or those types of things? Are those things starting to happen into your head now?
Yeah, they definitely do. In fact, I had to have a scene in unnecessary force describing a weapon system they were going to use, but the task force didn't have the weapon system, so I just created a character out of the CIA who's in Sudan, which has nothing to do with the book. It's just to eliminate the weapon system. And I like that character so much, I brought him over to the task force, and he's a valued member now, and he's expanding in Enemy of Mine.
Yeah, and
so that happens quite a bit.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that, you know, a lot of people are starting to gravitate to are those kinds of secondary characters and those kinds of ones that, you know, kind of standing out a little, and you're like, wow, you know, they're emailing me about that person, really, that's kind of odd. And so then the author starts realizing, hey, wait a second, I got something going on here.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, I guess it's a spoiler, but there's some people who die in the books, and I get some hate mail about, you know, I killed off a secondary character. What are you doing? I like that guy. I'm sorry about
right.
that. Hopefully it gave you some emotional tugs, because that was the intent of it. So.
And, you know, and the one thing that kind of helps, you know, military and political thrillers, of course, is the outside world and the stuff that goes on, you know, every day and things that happen. You know, of course, I guess the biggest story right now, you know, more along the lines of what you write is the Zero Dark Thirty movie and those types of things. Do people kind of, you know, email you or do they ask you the questions of, you know, what do you think of this or how do you think of that? And those
yeah.
types of stuff, you know, you get all of that too?
I definitely do. In fact, I have a blog that has nothing to do with writing books. It's on National Security Affairs. And I have a lot of, obviously I have a lot of information on that type of thing, but I have a lot of opinion blogs on there about various things we've done. And I actually was on an interview, like I said, Enemy of Mine's about an envoy they're trying to assassinate, and immediately it was like, oh, it looks just like Benghazi. You know, you're prescient. You can see the future.
Right.
And I wish it was the case. The truth of the matter is the Enemy of Mine was originally centrally located in Syria and Lebanon, and I had a good friend of mine, Special Forces officer, who was a defense attaché in the Syrian embassy, and I was headed to Syria to do research in Lebanon. He was a perfect guy. He's an Arabic speaker, Princeton graduate. I mean, just a genius guy. And I picked the wrong country because then Syria went up in flames, and he was dealing with car bombs. I couldn't get over there. They closed the embassy down, and it caused significant rewrites. Luckily, Hezbollah, Hamas, all that stuff, I see news stories every day, and I'm thinking, okay, that's tracking. That's exactly what I thought would happen, and it's, you know, it's parallels in Enemy of Mine.
Yeah, and, you know, since all those things are coming out, of course, all the school shootings, everything else going on, when you're writing, is there kind of one subject that you're like, you know what, I'm not gonna touch this, it's either too dark or it's something that, you know, you don't even really need to do while you're writing and, you know, figuring things out, you know, with your next book? Is there that subject that you just kind of like, it's off limits to you that you're not going to go there as an author?
I haven't found a subject yet like that. I will say that some people say my books are too violent, which there is a lot of violence in them, but there's some things I won't put on the page that I call gratuitous violence. In fact, Enemy of Mine is one. There's a climactic scene there. I'm not going to give it away, but my editor was saying, hey, you've got to really drag this out and show what's happening. And I said, no, that's not doing any justice to Pike. And it's not, that's just violence for violence's sake. I think the way I ended it is exactly, everybody knows what happens. There's no reason for me to drag this out with what I call gratuitous violence. So the violence I have in the books, I mean, we live in a violent world, and I've seen the violence out there, and it's there for a reason.
Yeah, and again, we're speaking here with author Brad Taylor. BradTaylorBooks.com is the website. The latest book is Enemy of Mine, the third in the Pike Logan thriller series. And Brad is definitely, you know, like I said, you're one of those authors now that's starting to get on a lot of people's radar between, you know, with the military and the political genre side. How are you kind of handling, you know, all of this kind of, you know, you could say fame. I mean, how are you kind of handling now all this attention that you're now starting to garner, you know, for your books? Was that something that you could even imagined, you know, when you first came out with, like, Run, Rough, you know, One Rough Man a couple of years ago?
No, not at all. In fact, it's your magazine asked what scares me. It seems like I'm doing right now that scares me. I don't like the interviews at all. I mean, I spent my entire military career being the guy in the corner who never talked at the parties because I wasn't allowed to say what I did. And I would always deflect conversation when someone said, what would you do? I'd say, I'm in the Army. What do you do? And get them talking. So now I have to get up and talk about me, about the books and things like that. And it's pretty scary. That's one thing that scares me.
Yeah, I mean, so when you're sitting there at a book signing and you have to go and you have to meet people and things like that, I mean, you know, was that just kind of overwhelming at the start, and now you kind of got a little bit used to it because now you've been doing it for a little bit, you know, for a little longer now. I mean,
yeah.
that had to be really hard at the beginning.
Yeah, definitely, and I wish I did get used to it, but I still get, you know, nervous as ever. What I really like doing are questions and answers, so I'll talk about the book and discuss the writing process and things like that, but the question and answers, it will always go to national security, and I'm pretty comfortable talking about that stuff, so I'll get questions about the death of Osama bin Laden, what do I think about al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, what do I think about Hezbollah and kidnappings and things like that, where do I think Yemen's going to go. Now, I'm comfortable talking about that stuff, so it's more my comfort zone than when someone asked me, how do you plot the book? I mean, I got that question last year, and I realized that I don't even know what my writing process is. I was like, how did I do that? I'm not really quite sure.
Well, here's something that's kind of off base then. A lot of the shows coming out, you know, you see like The Homeland, and you're starting to see some of these other shows that are coming out that are starting to become popular. Do you watch them? You know, what's kind of on your DVR? You know, what are you watching on TV?
I don't. I really don't watch those shows. It's not something. I hear they're great shows and they're, you know, well written and everything like that. But it's probably like a doctor doesn't read medical thrillers because a guy writing the book doesn't ever get it right. If I watch those shows, I sit there and go, that wouldn't happen. That's not right. And it takes it away
right.
from me. But it's not to take any away from the show. I just see it and I think that would never happen. And it kind of. My willing suspension of disbelief after about six times of that happening, it's just like, I'm changing channel.
So you got to go with the ones that you're like, I don't know anything about, that way I can actually watch and enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even, I was talking to my wife about it. I saw Skyfall. James Bond's one of my favorite characters of all time. And I love Casino Royale, and I love Daniel Craig in it. And so I'm watching Skyfall, and I, you know, there's some willing suspension of disbelief, but I can do it. You can shoot an offhand weapon and hit a guy, to, you know, 100 meters away on a moving train. Sure, I'll believe that. But then I started doing stuff, and I was just like, what? Where'd that come from? Huh? How'd that happen? And it kind of aggravated me. Everybody's like, I love Skyfall. I'm like, really? Well, did you ever wonder why Q, the new Q, picked an art gallery to meet James Bond in with all the cameras and security guards around attaching a handgun? I'm saying, that makes no sense. Why didn't him just say he doesn't have his place yet? Come up to my office.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
I just feel like I can't believe this.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing about James Bond is that sometimes it's just so kind of overwhelming, and it's just you're just like, it's so outlandish that it's just that interesting, I guess.
Well, I mean, I don't mind that. You know, they can do whatever they want to as far as bending a lot of the physics, but you know, sometimes when something happens, and it doesn't make sense. To anybody. I'm like, where did that guy come from? He just appeared out of nowhere? Those kind of things aggravate me.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, it's got to be difficult when you're kind of watching those things and you've been there and you've done it. And, you know, you've been in the firing lines and you've had to see it. And that's what, but that's the good thing about, you know, like we just talked with, you know, an author previous, you're writing about what you know. And that's what makes you successful and believable because you're not writing a medical thriller where you're probably getting a lot of stuff wrong. You're writing about what you know. So it's the realism and it's the passion and it's the emotion that you're putting into your books that people really bring out of it. And then they realize that this is, you know, that you're an author that has been there and done it and they can, you know, maybe not relate to you, but they can know that they're getting the real deal.
Yeah, you know, I'm not omnipotent. There's a lot of things I get wrong. I still have to do an enormous amount of research. There are things that I screw up all the time, and I'll get emails on it. And some things I should have known. For instance, in One Rough Man, they land in at Eagle Base in Tuzla, Bosnia-Herzegovina. And as they land, they see the Secret Service guys running around on the ground for the Secretary of State to visit. And I knew this, but I don't know why I said Secret Service. I immediately get an email from a Diplomatic Security Corps guy who says, we're the ones that do it. It's Diplomatic Security Corps from the State Department, not Secret Service. I'm like, yeah, I knew that. Doggone it. Luckily, I can fix it in the paperback. So all those corrections I get from readers, I definitely go back to the paperback and say, fix this, fix that, fix this.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess that's kind of the thing. You're just like, oh, I can't believe, how did I miss that? I mean, because you probably, how many times did you read the book? You probably reread it 100 times, and it's just one of those things you just overlook.
Oh, yeah. But not only me, and then, you know, I've got, like I said, the other readers who've read it before it even gets to my editor who reads it, who then goes to copy editor who reads it, and then it's still in there.
Yeah, and it's still that, because, like, if I was editing it, I would have just passed it over, probably having, like, no idea. I would have been like, oh, okay, that's just normal.
Yeah, that's probably what made through. But, I mean, there's even small things, like the biggest one, which is a lot of Carbuster American people probably, if you're listening, have heard this before, but I had Pike carjacks a Chevy Cutlass down in Guatemala, and I immediately get bazillions of emails because Oldsmobile made the Cutlass. So they were just, you know, how could you say it was a Chevy? And the sad thing is, I owned an Oldsmobile Cutlass in college, so no one to blame but myself on that one.
Well, now, the one thing that a lot of people might figure out is now, because you're all over, you know, you're on Facebook, Twitter, Goodreads, you know, how interactive do you like to get with the fans, you know, kind of, you know, that distance away where you don't have to really see them or talk to them, but you can just kind of type and whatnot, you know, how interactive do you like to get?
I'm really interactive. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that if anybody wants to talk to me, by all means, I enjoy the interaction with the fans. It just makes me nervous to do it, but it's not something I dislike. I greatly appreciate it when... Yeah, I answer every email that comes to me. People send me stuff on Facebook, I'll answer that. Anybody that's, and they're not only questions about the books, usually it's something mundane, like where can I get an Audible copy, something like that. Other times it's, hey, my son just enlisted in the Army, he's thinking about going Special Forces, do you have any advice for me? I definitely interact as much as I possibly can.
Yeah, and that's kind of funny because my daughter, her boyfriend just got out of basic and now he's going into Ranger school. And he's in Georgia doing that thing, so it's kind of all new and fresh to us because my dad was Lieutenant Colonel in the Air Force. He was a navigator, but this is kind of like new territory for us, is having to kind of see, you know, in today's day and age, you know, how my daughter is because she's 20 and, you know, her boyfriend and it's all this stuff. You know, it's very emotional.
Yeah, well, I know all about Ranger School, so good luck to him.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of weird. I had no idea that he had to kind of go out for 6 months, and then they bring him back, and then they say whether or not they're going to keep him or not. I'd like, wow, I never knew that.
Yeah, well, he must be going to Ranger Regiment. So if he's going to Ranger Regiment, yeah, they've got a hiring process, but he'll still be in the Army.
Yeah. He's in there now. He went in for infantry, and then he got accepted into Ranger, and now he's back doing Ranger training now, and he hasn't been deployed because he just got out of basic, and he came home for the holidays, and he just got back like January 1st, and now he's kind of doing all that fun stuff. So it's like, I kind of ask advice. I'm like, dude, I have no idea what you're going to experience. I can only tell you what my dad told me is in the Air Force, which is a lot easier than what he was playing cards a lot.
Yeah, well, he's going to have some good NCOs. He'll be well taken care of.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think he's enjoying it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just different. So, yeah, we have to kind of go through that. So you kind of see how all those experiences, you know, the stuff that you've been through and the stuff that you write about, kind of how it can affect now, you know, it can kind of affect you every day. And people, you know, you just got to realize that.
Yeah, and it's actually gratifying. When I get emails, a lot of people send emails about, you know, enjoying the book or what aspect of the book. And sometimes it's some things that I wrote that, I mean, like I said, the action scenes are easy. It's the characters that are hard. I want to write. Someday I hope to be known as, right now I'm known as an ex-SF guy that happened to write a book, and someday I hope I'm a damn good writer who happened to be an ex-SF guy.
Exactly.
I don't think I've reached that stage yet, but that's where I spend all my time, is developing the characters and the emotional impact of the novel itself. So when I get an email saying that somebody really connected with Pike or really connected with Jennifer, that means the most to me, and that's the hardest amount of work.
Well, I'll tell you what, Brad, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to be able to speak with you. And we know that, you know, the ceiling, there is none for you, that you're just going to keep going up because you are one of the best up-and-comers now in this genre, you know, with Vince Flynn, Vlad Thor, all of those, you're going to be in the same conversation. So that's going to happen soon for you.
I appreciate it. I hope so. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, and we'll talk to you later. So stay in touch with us and see what's going on with Pike Logan or anything else that you decide to maybe venture into in the next couple books.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good one, Brad. Enjoy yourself.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. So again, everybody, that is author Brad Taylor with his latest book, Enemy of Mine. You can find out bradtaylorbooks.com for a lot more information. Go back with One Rough Man, All Necessary Force, third in his Pike Logan thriller series. We would like to thank everybody who came on today, Judge James Bell for Vampire Defense, and then we just had on Robert Povey to talk about his book, Mannheim Rex. A lot of stuff going on here with the magazine to 2013. We have a lot of authors coming up here in February. We're changing the blog around a little bit. We're going to change some of the things in the magazine. We're going to try to add some more stuff. Lisa Gardner, New York Times bestselling author, is giving us her writer's toolbox to be able to publish in the magazine. Now, she has this on site, on her site, but we're going to be able to publish that in the magazine so people can read a lot of stuff about craft and writing and getting characters together and everything else. And so we're going to have that in there. But just a lot of other stuff that we're going to be doing here on the radio show, here on the blog, to just try to amp things up, because it's time now to start getting things going a little bit further. Heck, we got Michael, Iron Chef Michael Simon gave us three recipes for your romantic suspense Valentine's Day dinner that we're going to publish here in the February magazine. So, guys, you can be a little romantic and suspenseful with your significant other in preparing some of these dishes. And, that, again, that was from none other than Iron Chef Michael Simon. Came out of his book Carnivore, which you guys could check out. That's for meat eater lovers. So, vegans, you might not quite enjoy this. But, again, a lot of great things coming up. You know, you can check it out, suspensemagazine.com, and all the other stuff that we got going on. There's nothing like the stuff that we do, and we're just trying to keep things going and going and going. So we want to thank everybody here for, you know, coming on our first show of 2013. It's been fabulous. We love all the stuff that we get. You can email us anytime. We'll get you back anything that we got. So, hey, we're off. We're running. Football starts today. Super Bowl in 3 weeks. Life's going to be good for the next 3 weeks, and then it's just going to go downhill for me on the weekends. But until then, everybody, we will see you. Enjoy. SuspenseMagazine.com. Check everything out. Later.